Go ahead and turn to Job chapter 2. If you grab the bulletin on your way in, there's a teaching sheet where you can follow along with some of the main points of the message. And we are continuing through a series in Job. So we're in chapter 2 today. And I want to start out with a story that I came across a while back, and I saw it again today or this week. And the article is by the New York Post, and it's titled, "Cop's Tesla Runs Out of Battery Power During High-Speed Chase." Never want that to happen when you're a cop, right? The story goes, in Fremont, California, there was a cop in a Model S, a Tesla Model S, in a high-speed pursuit of a car, and he had to contact dispatch telling him they were reaching 120 miles per hour in this pursuit. And the cop calls dispatch and says, "I'm down to 6 miles of battery on the Tesla, so I may lose it here in a second." And soon after, the car that was being chased went into a congested area on the highway, and so they actually called off the pursuit. And from what I could read, the car got away. It was found later crashed into some bushes, but from what I could see, they never actually caught the person. And the Tesla driver, though, the officer, thankfully found a charging station in San Jose. So everyone, don't worry. He didn't run out of battery on the highway. But let me ask you, how many of you have ever felt like that police officer? Well, you're in the midst of life, and you just flat out run out of battery. And that's what happened to Job last week when we read chapter 1. Job was persecuted, and all these bad things happened, so he was suffering. And by the end of chapter 1, we see that he is out. He is out of battery. And by the end of chapter 2 that we're going to be looking at, the same thing's going to happen. Job's going to be on the ground in the ashes, just suffering from everything that is happening to him. But this time we're going to see in chapter 2, it's for a different reason. In chapter 1, he was suffering because of things that happened to him and around him. So he had those physical things that were taken away from him. His children died, and so there was a lot of external things that were causing the suffering. But in this chapter now, it goes to Job now physically suffering on his own. And we see, as we'll see in a moment, not only is he physically suffering, but we'll see that it is a direct attack from the devil there. And so by the end of the sermon, I hope that you're going to get a better understanding of what Satan wants to do with every one of us as well. And knowing that will help us so that as we go through life, instead of running out of battery in the middle of the life and sort of pushing our life car to the end, we can get through to the end strong. And so let's go ahead. Let's take a look at Job chapter 2. If you remember from last week, I talked about how there was these different scenes. It started out in heaven and then went down to, it started out in, now I'm forgetting what happened in chapter 1 there. Well, we had three scenes, two in heaven, one in earth, I think is what, sorry. Now I'm remembering. See, this is what happens when I go off script. It started out in earth, and then it went up to heaven. That was scene 2, and then it went back down to earth in scene 3. And so now at chapter 2, it continues really the narrative here, and we're in scene 4, back up in heaven. And you're going to notice that a lot of the same language used at the beginning here in chapter 2 is the same language that's used in chapter 1. So let's begin with Job chapter 2, verse 1. "Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan himself came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where have you come?' And Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? And there is none like him on all the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason.' Then Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Skin for skin, All that the man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life. So again, God is up there and Satan comes up to him. And God essentially says, what's going on? Satan says, roaming the earth, causing trouble. And God says, have you considered my servant Job? I talked about last week. Why did he do that? I don't know. And sometimes we don't understand what God is doing. But again, poor Job gets selected there. And God says that even though, Satan, you caused an enormous amount of suffering in his life last chapter, so to speak, go ahead and have at it again. And Satan gets a little bit defensive, right? He says, skin for skin. And commentaries and scholars don't actually know what that means, but they think it's something like an idiom where we might say something like tit for tat or something like that, where it doesn't quite make sense. But the basic idea is that he's saying, poo-poo on you, God. Yeah, right? Of course he's not going to sin against you because you're protecting him. Never mind that he used this exact same line about blessings just in the last meeting with him. But he says that that's because you've protected his life. And so God goes ahead and he gives him permission to have at it with Job again. And so now we go to the last scene on sort of this section here. In scene 5, we're back down to Uz, starting in verse 7. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of pottery with which to scrape himself. And he sat in the ashes. So this is the first time here that we see that Satan is directly attacking Job. Before, in chapter 1, Satan used other nations or even Mother Nature, so to speak, with lightning to attack Job and to cause suffering in Job. But now, Satan's just like, boom, right at Job. And so now, Job is suffering with some sort of horrible skin disease. We don't know what it is. There's lots of speculation that I read about this week. Some thought it was leprosy. Others thought it was something called elephantiasis. And whatever it was, it sounded bad, doesn't it? It sounds like something that we don't want to experience, where it was so bad that you had to take something hard and just start scraping your skin there to get rid of whatever is causing the itch or the pain there. And so this is a picture right here of how far Job has fallen. The beginning of chapter 1, he was doing well, he was rich, he was prosperous, he was living a blessed life, and now he has gone all the way down to sitting in the dirt, scraping his skin with a broken pottery piece. So if only there was someone in his life that could help him. So enter his wife. Verse 9. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. Not being very helpful, is she? Now, so his wife has been there. She's not the main character, obviously, but she has been there from the beginning, seeing all that Job has gone through. And we forget that she has suffered a lot as well. She was rich. She was the one who had those children that all have died now. So she is suffering a lot herself. But she now sees where her husband is at. And she essentially tells him that she should just curse God. Meaning, in that time, if you curse God, what would happen to you? You die. Yeah, so this is a polite way of telling her husband, hey, husband, I love you, but it's over. It's over. Go ahead and kill yourself. That's essentially the advice that the wife is giving to him. So Job responds by saying in verse 10, But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?" And here's the key. In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. He's saying, "Are you crazy, wife? Are you crazy? God has blessed us in so many different ways. Doesn't he have the right to do with us what he wants?" And the key here, again, is that in this, Job did not sin. The author wants you to see that at the beginning of chapter 2, Satan says, Job will sin if you cause him to suffer, if you take away that protection. And then in verse 10, we see Job did not sin. He did not sin. Okay, so I think we would agree that the wife was not very helpful. So if only he had some friends that could come and support him along this time and help him in this suffering. So enter three friends, verse 11. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that he had come that had come upon him, they came each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Nahamathite. And they made an appointment together to come and show him sympathy and comfort him. So they were coming from distant areas and came to see their friend. And when they heard about this, they traveled to see him. So I want you to understand here that the word friend in the Old Testament is different than how we might understand friend today. So friends in the Old Testament were much deeper and much more intimate than us. I have 693 friends. But honestly, if many of them walked in front of me, I probably wouldn't even remember some of their names. 693 friends, because we have a different use of the word friends. But look at Proverbs chapter 18. A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. And so Job's friends were not just, these were not just casual acquaintances or social media friends, so to speak, that were coming to check him out and to see what's going on. These were his close friends who traveled a long trip to see him. So think about, who would you be willing to see? Who do you know that you're close enough with that you would travel from here in Hampstead and drive all the way to Anchorage, Alaska to see? So I looked it up. It takes 76 hours to drive from here to Alaska. And so that would come out to be, if you drove 8 hours a day, that'd be about a 9.5-day trip. And so this is not a casual relationship here. I mean, most of you, I'd like you. I won't drive to Alaska for you. And it probably goes both ways here. This is a level of friendship here. This is what we're talking about, the type of friends that came to see Job. So let's go ahead and let's see what happens now in verse 12. And when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him, and they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. So when they see him, they are in shock. Because Job is no longer this wealthy, well-to-do, blessed man. Now he's this guy that is suffering physically in ashes and just looks totally different. So much so, they don't even recognize him. And so they start out, when they see him, by weeping and tearing their robes and putting dust on their heads. Those are all sort of normal cultural ways to express mourning in that period. And so then they sit with him and they don't say anything. They don't say anything the first day or the second day or the third day. All the way for 7 days, they don't say a word. And this right here is where I think the friends went from helpful to not helpful. So it's one thing if you want to go and sit with someone and just sort of be there to support them. But we may do that for a day, but not for 7 days. 7 days, that's essentially sitting with him and ignoring him now. And what they're doing actually symbolizes they are mourning for the dead. Let me read what one commentator says. A 7-day silence symbolized mourning for the dead. It was what Joseph did for his father Jacob. It is what the loyal city of Ramoth Gilead did for King Saul in 1 Samuel 31. Job's friends mourn for him as one already dead. So just like his wife, it's as if they have gone up to him, seen his condition, and essentially said, he's a goner. He's gone. Job, it's over. Give up. Now we'll continue looking at the conversations that they have after that period in the coming chapters. But for now, we're at the end of the chapter. I want to stop and just think about what this means for us. I want to ask a very important question here. What can we learn from this chapter? And there were a lot of different directions I could have gone. In fact, I wrote out a couple different areas that I was going to talk about, but the sermon just kept getting longer and longer. So I decided that we're just going to narrow in on one aspect of this story here and give you one thing to think about for the rest of the time. And that is that Satan is out to attack and destroy people. He wants to destroy Job, but listen, he also wants to destroy us. Again, in verse 3, God says to Satan, he, Job, still holds fast to his integrity. Although you, Satan, incited me, thank God, against him to destroy him without reason. And so this is the real reason why Satan wants to get to people. He wants to destroy them. Satan is roaming around on the earth looking for people to devour. 1 Peter 5:8, Peter says, be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. And so the story of Job here and these chapters, 1 and 2 in particular, give us an illustration here of the spiritual battle that really all of us are in, but shows us where Satan is at in this. So listen, whether we want to be or not, we are at war. There is a battle we have with Satan. Whether you are a follower of God or not, Satan is out there and he wants to devour you. Whether you are a good person in your mind or not, Satan wants to devour you. Whether you are doing good things and following God or not doing good things and not following God, Satan wants to devour you. He is looking for any opportunity he can to get to people and to destroy them. And that's why Peter says to be sober-minded and watchful. To be sober-minded and watchful. So he is saying, hey, watch out, because the devil is out there and he wants to get to you. Now, before I go any further and talk about the importance of being watchful, I want to just sort of lay the foundation here to make sure that you're not being overly watchful. And I like how C.S. Lewis describes it. Oh, and I lost my page here. C.S. Lewis describes it in this way. He says, there are two equal and opposite errors in which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve their existence, and the other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves are equally pleased by both errors and hail a materialist or a magician with the same delight. So all of us, we will have problems if we act as if Satan and the devils don't exist, or we will have problems if we look too much into them and give them too much credit and too much power in our life. So what we need to do as Christians is to be in the middle there. Peter says, be sober-minded and watchful, but don't go on this side and don't go on this side either. So let's be aware of what's going on, but let's not be afraid of what's going on. Let's be, as Peter says, watchful. Watchful. I remember when my wife and I bought our first house in Gaithersburg, Maryland. It was this little house in this little community, and our kids were little, just little kids. Julia was just a little newborn. And one day, I took them out on a walk. This particular neighborhood has had sidewalks. And so I put them in the stroller, and I started pushing them down the sidewalk. Well, I get about 15 houses down, and all of a sudden, this dog comes out of nowhere, charging me and barking. And let me tell you, I can't say what I did in my pants, what I almost did in my pants, but I was scared. It was just like, poof, out of there. Now, it turns out that it was just a little poodle. So it wasn't nearly as scary as it should have been, or as it shouldn't have been scarier. But because it just sort of snuck out of nowhere, I was scared. But next week, when I went for a walk and went down that same path, I was ready. I bought a little collapsible baton just in case, and I was ready just in case any dogs were gonna come at me. So I'm walking along here, and I see the same dog, but this time he decided to stay close to his house. So because I was ready for him, because I wasn't surprised, he wasn't nearly as scary the second time as he was the first time. Now let me ask you, when was the poodle attack the scariest? It was when I didn't know he was coming. It was when he surprised me. And once I knew, though, he was coming, I wasn't nearly as afraid. Because what is the worst thing that a poodle attack can do? Get you a little slobbered and maybe a little bit of nips there. But the poodles aren't going to hurt you too much. And likewise, listen, when is Satan most effective? It's the same way. It's when we don't expect him. It's when we're not looking for him. It's when we're not watchful and ready. Because if we know he's out there, then we will be prepared for the attacks that are going to come from him. But here's the cool thing. Now, fast forwarding to the New Testament. Now, as New Testament Christians, this is an amazing verse for us to hold on to. For he who is in you, you being those that follow Jesus Christ, is greater than he who is in the world. So if you are a follower of Jesus Christ, then you don't have to fear the attacks of Satan. Because God is greater and more powerful than Satan. So I want to turn this into a math equation. I'm not very good at math, but put a little equation together here. So here's the first part. God is greater. And then you add that to plus Satan is lesser. And then next we see plus I am on God's side. And all that equation equals what can man, or we'll add Satan, do to me? What can man do to me? And that's why the psalmist declares in Psalm 118 verse 6, the Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do to me? Satan can try to trip us up, but he can't destroy us. He can try to deceive us, but he will only deceive us if we let him. He can try to distract us, but he can only distract us if we let him. And so even with Job here, listen, I know this concept is difficult for all of us to understand, but even with Job, the only way that Satan could get to Job was when God gave him permission. So let's be watchful and ready. And Satan will come out there and he will try to bark loudly, but he is nothing more than a little poodle if you let him. I remember when I was in my 20s, when I went on a mission trip to Ghana, and one time we were in a village and we were staying in this old house. And one night I went to bed, I was in a room by myself, and I wake up and I felt this most evil sense that I'd ever felt before, just sort of hovering above me. And let me tell you, I had to go to the bathroom, but guess what I did that day? I held it. And I did the classic way of protecting myself. I held the sheets up to my neck. I'm just saying this because I'm not Mr. Spiritual here. You know, I didn't do this the best way. I'm just saying what happened. And I continued to pray and pray and pray until I fell back asleep. But you know what happened in the morning? Nothing. Nothing happened in the morning. Because again, Satan can bark at me, but he can't touch me unless God lets him. So again, if I'm in God, what can man do to me? There's another story that I read, I think I've shared this before, about an English evangelist named Smith Wigglesworth. And I'm just going to admit right now that he has a cooler name than mine. And he handles this situation a little bit better than I did. But he was involved in an evangelistic meeting when he was preaching and praying for 36 hours straight. And so at the end of that time, he was tired, the story says. And I would say that's an understatement. So he decides to dismiss everyone, and he goes to bed for a few hours. He lays down, falls asleep quickly. Well, about 30 minutes into sleeping, he feels this sensation like his bed is being shaken. And he opens his eyes, and he sees what he feels is, it looks like the like a manifested devil or evil spirit just sitting on the edge of his bed. And I love what happens in the story here. It says, after he cleared his eyes, it is reported that he said, "Oh, it's only you." And Smith Wigglesworth rolled over and immediately went back to sleep. Because if you have put your faith in Jesus Christ, then there is no reason to fear the devil. There's no reason. And so knowing all this, I'm going to give you two actions to take this coming week. Two things to think about and two things to pursue. And the first is this, that we need to abide in the shadow of the Almighty. And that comes from Psalm 91, where the psalmist says, "He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. And I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. For he will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the deadly pestilence." So let's think about this verse now, these verses. He's saying that he is safe when he goes off and does his own thing. Is that what he's saying? No, he's saying that he is safe when he is in the shelter of the Most High. He is safe when he is abiding in the shadow of the Almighty. And so the closer that you are to God, the safer that you are, and the less likely that you're going to wander off. And since Satan can't get to you, the only thing that he can do is bark at you. The only thing that he can do is try to draw you away from that shelter. So that's what he's going to be gearing to do. That's what he's going to try to do. And the further that you walk from God, the more that you do that, the more likely you are at risk for falling into danger and falling into trouble. So I want to encourage you, do all that you can Do all that you can in your power to abide in the shadow of the Almighty. And so surround yourself with good Christian friends that are going to encourage you and strengthen you and really to hold you accountable in areas. Get in the Bible. Spend time in prayer. Spend time in worship and focusing on getting to know God. So if you do all these things, the more that you can get these in your life, the more that you will abide in the shadow and the safer that you'll be. I want to give you one more thing to think about, one more thing sort of as an action step. And that is what I might call a non-action step, and that's to don't be led astray by the lies of Satan. I read from author Tim Downs. He wrote a book called Head Games, and he wrote about Alexander the Great. And he says that when the army was retreating one time, he gave orders for them to construct these oversized breastplates and helmets that would fit people who were 7 or 8 feet tall. And so they would make these, and as they were retreating, they would just sort of leave them along the way for the pursuers to find. And the goal was to demoralize the enemy that was pursuing them so that they would eventually abandon pursuit. And I was, after I read that, I said, that's what Satan's trying to do. He is in retreat. He is the lesser here. But he's going to make these big lies. He's going to make these big claims. And they're only going to be as powerful as we let them, if we let them lead us astray. So again, his effectiveness is really up to you. So let me close with this story here. And this is about a pastor who was talking to a woman. The pastor tells a story. He went up to a woman and started sharing Jesus with her. This was outside. And after he shares with her for a little bit, he asks her if she wants to become a Christian. And she says she does. And so he talks to her and says, all right, now repeat after me. I'm going to pray. And he closes his eyes and says something along the lines of, Lord, I thank you for sending your son. And he wanted her to repeat. And so she says, Lord, I thank. And it stops because right behind them, her car horn starts honking. And they look at it, and it's so loud that she can't keep following him because it's too loud. So the pastor goes over, and there's nothing wrong with the car. And finally, they open up the hood, and they disconnect the horn. And then he continues with the prayer. And she prays and becomes a Christian. And this, again, illustrates, as I've been talking about, all he can do is honk at you. That's all he can do. So if you will abide in the shadow of the Almighty, then you are safe. You don't have to fear him. But listen, you do need to be aware of what he's trying to do with each of us, what he's trying to do to you. And so I want to encourage you to stick close to God. And if you have never put your faith in Jesus Christ, that's the starting point right there. You can't abide in the shadow of the Almighty if you've never turned to Jesus Christ and given him your life. And so turn to him. Turn to him when the jailer was about to kill himself in Acts and decides that he wants to turn to Jesus. He says, what must I do to be saved? And all they say is, believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. And I want to ask you, do you believe that? Will you believe that today? Turn to him right now. In a moment, we're going to be singing. And even right then, you can turn and ask him to be the Lord of your life. And for others here today, you've done that before, but maybe you have gotten a little too far away from the shelter. As we go into a time of singing, I want to encourage you to spend time talking to God and asking him for help to get you back on path. Father, I pray.